I will call to order the March 16th meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules, and open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2556. Mr. Stembridge, please tell us about this bill.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, this is House Bill 2556. It is a teamwork bill, one of eight teamwork bills that you have under House rules. This measure prohibits statewide elected officials elect, legislators and legislators elect, from soliciting or receiving political contributions between Election Day and the first day of the legislative session.
Thank you, Mr. Stembridge. And we have in the room Representative Ben Cannon. Would you like to come forward and tell us about the bill?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ben Cannon. I represent House District 46 in Portland, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. Thank you for hearing this bill. I guess as a teamwork bill, you didn't have a choice, but I am glad that you are looking at many aspects of campaign finance, how we sort of organize our own house and operations. I think sometimes these conversations about ourselves are some of the most difficult to engage in, and I appreciate the willingness of this committee to look not just at this bill, but at others that have to do with our own operations and the way that we work and do business here. I want to make it clear at the outset that my real interest regarding campaign finance is in fundamental reform of the system, and this bill is not that. This bill, as the administrator described, would prohibit donations between Election Day and the start of the legislative session. I have some other ideas about the direction that campaign finance reform ought to head. I'm very excited by what my city, the city of Portland, is doing, allowing folks to gather enough $5 contributions to trigger a certain amount of public financing. Arizona and other states have adopted something along those lines of public financing. In my own campaign, I went door-to-door and got small-dollar donations from folks who were, I think, excited and inspired by the Portland model of campaign financing. It's an even more radical idea that I think is pretty exciting. If you took that $50 tax credit that we enjoy and you turn it into a voucher for all Oregonians and said, $50, give it to a candidate, and made that the only permissible donation, you'd be using, I think, a market system to radically change the way that we do campaign finance in the state. And I think that's something that I'd love to work with you to take a look at. As I said, House Bill 2556 does not represent comprehensive campaign finance reform, doing little to change the basic dynamic of our campaign finance system. However, I do think it's a small improvement to the existing system, and for that reason I support it. So what's wrong with our system now that this bill, 2556, would improve? There is a problem of perception, and I don't think I need to spend very long on this because I think it's pretty evident. Money that is donated before Election Day appears in the spirit of helping get someone elected. And money that appears after Election Day appears in the spirit of gaining access to power. Now, reality is more complex than that scenario. I don't believe that there are members of this body who would put their time, or worse yet, their votes up for sale. And my experience, my short experience in this body, has taught me one of the lessons, the sort of strongest lessons that I take back to my district and share, is the degree to which members of this body are motivated, I think, by very best of intentions, by real deep integrity, and I'm certainly not here to suggest that the contrary is true. However, money does have an influence on this process, I think a more nuanced and complex one than that sort of, you know, money for vote sort of scenario. And rather than the public imagining sort of nefarious arrangements reached in back alleys, they should imagine the kinds of social and cultural arrangements that money helps produce, I think, between legislators, interest groups, and lobbyists, arranging who we know, who we spend time with, the values that we implicitly come to share. The bottom line, though, is really that post-election donations, in my view, contribute to an erosion of public trust in this institution. And I'm talking here about perception. That is the public perception. I don't think it's entirely correct. As I've said, it's a complicated kind of scenario, but it's a perception that has very real effects. And I can't tell you the number of people I met as I went door-to-door in my district who expressed the feeling that the legislative process is dominated by big money, special interest powers. And I think it's our obligation to try to craft changes to this system, even if we don't entirely overhaul it, that will help address those perceptions. And finally, I want to address the question of borrowing, because I think very often it's the case that these post-election contributions are used to offset debts that a campaign has incurred during the election cycle. I guess I just wonder why the law should encourage that practice of borrowing and then paying off debts after the election. Why should a campaign spend more than it has earned before election day? Why do we turn the process into a high-stakes game of poker where candidates are encouraged to borrow chips in order to bet all in on election day royal flush? I mean, that's sort of the scenario, and it's a hard position to put a candidate in. I think it's a hard position for a candidate to be in, where there is some pressure to say, well, it looks like if I spend a little more now, I can win, and then the debt will be repaid. Money that stays on the sidelines until a winner is announced, frankly, isn't money that should be in the system at all. We have strict reporting rules for donations received during the session. My caucus, and the Republicans may as well, has a policy of not accepting donations at all. I urge you to extend that firewall between private dollars and the public interest back to Election Day. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Any questions for Representative Cannon? So, Representative Cannon, we have in front of us a letter from the Department of Justice. I think it's actually a formal opinion. I don't know if you've seen it yet.
I have not, Madam Chair.
Which does raise some constitutional questions about other provisions, such as what you referred to. We used to have, by statute, a ban on contributions during legislative session. This opinion seems to say quite definitively that provisions like that and others are unconstitutional, and I think similar questions might be raised about the concept presented in House Bill 2556. I know you haven't had a chance to look at this. Representative Lim, if you'd like to come forward and join Representative Cannon.
I appreciate it.
But I don't know if you've had a chance to consider the constitutionality of what's proposed here.
I have, Madam Chair. I had not seen this opinion from the Department of Justice. It does appear pretty clear-cut. I certainly would not urge this committee to adopt a law that is in violation of the Constitution. There are sort of larger questions related to the degree to which money is speech, and bans on money or bans on speech. I'm of the opinion that money should not be regarded in that category, and that the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in that regard should be challenged. This may not be the time and place to do it, and I would respectfully defer to the committee's thought and thinking regarding moving forward, given a Department of Justice opinion that appears to say that this is not that this violates the Oregon Constitution. That's a long and ongoing conversation, as you know.
Any other questions for Representative Cannon? Representative Lim, good morning.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Lim from the District 50, which is Gresham area. And I do appreciate, Madam Chair, that they're having a public hearing on this House Bill 2556. I'm not sure what have you been talking about it. let me comment at the beginning about the constitutionality. Of course, I read it, I understand it, and of course there's a question on the constitutionality on this bill, and that the constitutionality issue is certainly concerning the fundraising event during the session. Am I correct on that point? But my bill does not talking about the during the session. This is talking about the after the election and then before the session. So maybe we might have some little different angle and different possibility on this bill. I believe this bill is one of the important bills to bring the integrity and trust of the legislators and elected officials in our state. And as you know, that the, our elected legislators, the rating as low as the car salesmen. And in the state, that's all the known facts. And I'm hoping through this legislation, we try to bring back that what it should be. We already have a house rule, ethic rule, and that the prohibiting any contribution from the public during the session. And then also we have a house rule, that ethic rule, that the, we cannot take more than $10 on a food or any gift items. And still, and when I think this is a good thing to do, but and while we are limiting that the contribution not more than $10 on gift and food, and through the back door, we are raising close to $1 million after the election and then before the session. And this brings a matter of credibility and trust. Why do they contribute close to one excuse me, close to $1 million, pardon me, to the legislators after the election? This is simply buying the influence and access to the legislators. I think we need to close this loophole. If someone wants to contribute, they should contribute before the election. Not. Thank you very much. Anyone wants to contribute to the elected officials or the candidate, they should contribute before the election time. Simply after the election, that the giving to the individual of elected representative or statewide officials or the caucus, such as the Future PAC or the Republican Victory PAC, this is simply buying out the influence. We need to close this loophole, otherwise our credibility, our trust is still on the line. So out of that concern, and I'm sure you read the Oregonian some time ago. I have the copy here written by the Dave Hogan. I'm sure you read that. And out of that concern, I thought this might be a good thing for the elected officials to do something about it. So with that, I will close my testimony and open for the questions if you have.
Thank you very much, Representative Lim, for your comments. Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lim, thank you for your testimony and for your efforts. We do run into the constitutional problem. I really wish it wasn't so, but if we are going to limit campaign contributions, we will need to amend the Constitution to allow for limits. We can limit ourselves through House rules. That's because we can regulate ourselves because we have the ability to do that under the Constitution. However, as I understand the rulings that the Attorney General's letter refers to, we cannot legally limit contributions either before Election Day or after Election Day. And because we can't do this for statewide officials, our only power, as far as I understand it, is to put rules on ourselves as members of the House. So I do understand where you're coming from with it. The first time I heard the phrase an oops contribution, I didn't know what they were talking about, but it was explained to me that there was a contribution made because someone had backed the wrong candidate, the one that didn't win. So after the election, oops, I better give this person a contribution to kind of make up for it. So it is a problem. I do agree it is a problem, but I just don't see that we can legally make this step until we pass a constitutional amendment that allows for limits on contributions for campaigns.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative Vice Chair Buckley, let's leave the question of constitutionality to the court to interpret. And then let's pass this bill, hopefully, and then show to the people what we can do. Already, such as many other states, Alabama and California, Louisiana, and other states already have this kind of law. And then Hawaii and Kentucky, other states also similar kind. So if we're talking about the constitutionality, they might have the same problem as ours, but they do have this law in their book. So my basic idea is that bringing back the trust and integrity of this great body of legislature, and then let's leave up to the court, the Supreme Court, interpret this law. If they have to, they could be this one constitutional, maybe this could be unconstitutional. And let's not decide at this moment. As a legislative body, let's do just what we can do, because there is already precedent in other states doing that. But by the way, I have an amendment in here, the proposal amendment, which allow, in case the elected legislators and then a statewide elected officials, in case if they do have a death, at least I have an amendment so they can take the contribution to retire their debt. So this is the amendment I have.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Madam Chair. You know, Representative, you and I agree 99.9% of the time. But this time of taking this out on a spin to see if it's unconstitutional, to me, is a waste of public dollars. ORS 261.174 violates Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, is therefore not enforceable. That's a pretty definite statement. I think the way we should approach this, and we can't do it through House rules, of course, because that only pertains to the House. It doesn't mean anything with the Senate, doesn't mean anything with the governor, the Secretary of State, or any other statewide official. I think the only way we can approach this is to send this out for amendment to the Constitution. That would be the only way we can go about this. The Constitution, to me, is very sacred in the state of Oregon. And the reason other states have it is because there's such a difference in constitutions in the states. I believe ours in Ohio is pretty much on the same line. I believe it's Ohio. So there, especially Article 1, Section 8, I've gone through a couple of bouts with Article 1, Section 8, and I uphold the Constitution, and I think this is unconstitutional. So therefore, I think the only way we can do it is to send it out and have the Constitution change if you want to proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then Representative Esquivel, I do appreciate your interpretation of the Constitution. If we are talking about the Constitution, which I agree 100%, then why do we have ethic law in our body limiting $10 food and then a gift? If you can explain to me clearly, this is a good thing to do. That's the ethic law we passed. Why we all agreed to pass that ethic law, and then saying this is one thing is a good thing, this is not unconstitutional. If someone clearly explained that to me, then.
I think I can answer that question. I think that the reason is because we adopted those rules by a vote voluntarily, as opposed to having a law that imposes restrictions that people may or may not have agreed with. So I think that's the difference, is a law versus voluntary rules.
And Madam Chair?
Yes.
Then could we adopt this rule voluntarily also from our legislative body instead of trying to pass this rule?
I certainly think it would probably be possibly permissible to do that if there were a majority vote to do so. And Vice Chair Berger.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I think that Senator Lim's point is well taken. We, on one hand, profess to great moral authority here in our rules, and yet there's a hole so big you can drive a Mack truck through it in our sort of ability to just raise money for campaigns. And I kind of agree the constitutional issues make it very difficult to get at this big hole, but I think I agree with Senator Lim that from the public's perception it's sort of silly that we limit ourselves to $10 during a campaign and rise on our moral high horse about it and yet take untold amounts of dollars right after the campaign. And I'm also quite taken with Representative Cannon's interesting point about campaign debt and raising money. It's really easy for the winner to pay off their debt. It's a lot harder for the losers to pay off their debt. And there's a big issue there around this debt thing. So I think we have to keep I don't know how we're going to get there. We tried some constitutional change on campaign financing through the initiative process. It's very hard for this body to come up with consensus for referral for constitutional change, but I think we need to keep thinking about it and talking about it, and I'm very pleased that these folks have come forward to bring this forward, because we can't just say, oh, problem, let's just stop here and not go further and not look for other creative ways to get at some of this, because this is a case where public perception is absolutely right. There's oddities and discomforting amounts of money in our process that make no sense, and it gives rise to a huge cynicism about what we do here, and that's very discomforting.
Representative Roblin.
Yeah, just a couple things. First, you know, in the last election, we had a ballot measure that would have changed the Constitution, which would have allowed this. And the people chose to not pass that, even though they passed another piece of legislation which imposed things that you can't do if you don't have the Constitution. So it is a frustrating deal to look at out there and see what is it and how are we going to go about changing it. I also appreciate the concept here, but I do want to ask a question of Representative Lim with regard to the amendment, because that bothers me even more, and I'll explain why. If I happen to be a wealthy person and I don't want anybody to know where I'm getting my money from, I could bankroll my whole election and then have worked it out with some people ahead of time that at the end I'm going to have this loan and I'd like you to pay me back. And then they could pay all that back right after the election under this amendment, and there would not have been any of the disclosure that we do, which we are so proud of. I mean, one of the issues with respect to Oregon law is that you can't limit it because of our Constitution, but on the same time, we can make sure that it's as open as possible. And with the new, even though we're all learning how to do that, with the new reporting standards where it's out there all the time, people know where the money's coming from so they can watch that. And I think that's helped to make an informed public. With your amendment, I think it could circumvent some of that ability to know where the money's coming from. I guess I'd ask any concerns you have about that.
Thank you. Madam Chair Rosenbaum and Representative Roblin, of course I thought about it. And then when I introduced this bill, and that some of our colleagues expressed some concerns retiring the debt. And we can make millions of laws. If someone wants to break the law, there's always some loophole there. And when we are making law, just making the law out of common sense, And if we were able to keep it 99% clear, maybe 1% out there bad apples might do it, that still we accomplished 99%. And thank you very much for the comment that the even Representative Berger made. And but if you want to fix the real problem, let's fix the real problem instead of a cosmetic approach. Yeah, and then a smile in the back door. Yeah, you know, give me $1 million. That is not the right way to do. And if you see the historically, always the majority party will get more money. That's for sure. Why? And because they like to get more influence and more access to the majority party because they are in power. Especially in our state, it's a one-party rule. And I see that in the governors, both houses of the chamber under the control of Democrat, and they are going to give a lot of money, whoever in control. And then we have seen this, and somehow we need to fix real problem, not just the cosmetic problems.
Do you think that there's a possibility that if this were to change, that people would just front load the process and more money would be given before the election instead of after?
Madam Chair, could I take a shot at that? I think if you really put your practical hat on, what would happen is some of those donations that are currently given to the winner after Election Day would come in the last few days before the election when the polling was predictive enough that they could make a similar decision with the money. So that's actually been one of my concerns about this. Well, do you just simply move that giving a little earlier in the process? I think you would move some of it earlier in the process. I think some of it would just stay on the sidelines without a clear determination or clear knowledge of who the winner is. But I think that's a legitimate concern. Perhaps Representative Lim would like to answer as well, but I would say, and it's sort of to Representative Roblin's point, there is an apparent contradiction between the public's unwillingness to accept in referendum constitutional changes that would allow us to limit contributions and their distrust of this body based on the amount of contributions that we receive during campaigns. And I'm very interested, and I think the public would be interested in us sort of voluntarily, as we've done through our ethics rules, limiting ourselves. And I think that's sort of the direction that vote sends us in. And I think holding a hearing like this speaks to that willingness on this body's part to at least consider on its own voluntarily addressing this subject of limits. And we do have within our power to voluntarily bind this legislature, not future legislatures, but at least this legislature to that kind of policy. So I think that, you know, through this conversation, we might be moving towards, I hope we are moving towards some sort of agreement around that.
Okay. I believe that the Representative Cannon well covered the point. And then this is the team bill. And I had a very difficult time getting two Democrats joining me to have a team bill. But two representatives, especially young and new, older ones very slippery. Young ones with a new idea and with a new approach, they were willing to sign on this team bill. And I just want to appreciate Ben Cannon and then David Edwards that giving me at least opportunity to have a public hearing. As a matter of fact, I didn't believe this will go all the way through House and the Senate and the governor will sign it. But at least I wanted to raise the issue and know of this problem, and hopefully we can fix some of the problem.
Madam Chair, I think he means to say that we were too young to know any better.
Well, we're sure that won't last. Did you have a comment?
No,
yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Madam Chair,
SunRep limb. Does the Senate, I can't remember, we didn't have this rule where we didn't accept contributions, do we, during session? Do we have that rule in the Senate?
I don't believe we do, but each, Madam Chair and Representative Esquivel, where I was a senator, we had an unwritten rule that don't accept any contribution. We limited ourselves, but we didn't have any specific rules on that where I was a senator.
Madam Chair, what I'm trying to get at here is I wonder if we couldn't get the Senate to adopt those rules as well as get the governor to sign on, whomever the governor is, and let's have a voluntary basis. I'd be the first to sign in the House. That wouldn't bother me. But to go up against the constitutional is very adamant by the Department of Justice. Right. This is unconstitutional. Other than changing the Constitution, I think the only way we can go about it is a voluntary basis. But I think you're pointing in the right direction. I just don't know how to get there.
Thank you. Well, thank you both for bringing this forward. Congratulations, Representative Lim, on having a teamwork bill. And I believe that you have the honor of having the very first teamwork bill to go through the process and be heard. So on behalf of the committee, no not. I'm told that's not the case.
We have one in revenue.
That's right. Okay.
We have one in revenue.
Oh, perhaps the second team. But at any rate, congratulations. Thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
It's been a very good discussion.
Appreciate
thank you both.
It.
We do have another witness signed up. And Bruce Bishop, would you please join us? Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing this morning on behalf of the Capital Club, whom I'm serving as president this year. I want to compliment the committee for being here on a Friday morning when the sky is blue, the grass is green, and the cherry trees are blooming.
Mr. Bishop, thank you, but we are here every Friday morning. Rain or shine.
You're not here always when the sky is green, the grass is green, and the cherry trees are blooming. And I want to also answer the question I think that is on the minds of many people in the building. When will the Capital Club directory be available? And the answer is soon. We hope to have the directory for 2007 available next week. So I know you're all looking forward to that. Thirdly, with regard to the bill, what I want to do is to at least point out to the committee that the Capital Club, which is a private association, has standards of professional conduct that all of our members agree to when we apply for membership in the Capital Club. That standard, among those standards, is a prohibition on making a political contribution to a legislator or a candidate during the legislative session. That's a longstanding policy of the Capital Club. When the law has changed and when the Constitution has changed, to say that it is an unconstitutional prohibition, a violation of freedom of speech for those sorts of laws to be on the books, the Capital Club, as a private organization, has maintained our policy to prohibit those contributions. We are by no means suggesting that we are above the law. We also agree to follow the law and the rules of the House and the Senate in our professional advocacy activities. But we have maintained a high professional standard, I think, to say that we believe that contributions during a legislative session are inappropriate and our members will not participate in that activity. That's not squarely on the bill before you, but we do want you to know that that's a policy that we believe in and will continue to expect our members to adhere to. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you for your testimony. And are there any questions for this witness? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for coming forward this morning. And that will be all. Representatives, that, I think, completes our sign-up sheet. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 25 56, please come forward and identify yourself for the record. Good morning.
Chair Rosenbaum and the members of the committee, I'm Norman Turrell. I'm the first vice president and action chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The assertion was made during this hearing that Measure 46 did not pass because people didn't want to amend the Constitution to prohibit contributions. I wanted to point out to the committee, as many of you already know, that Measure 46 had two features, one of which was to also impose a supermajority on the legislature of a three-quarters vote. And many of us objected to that feature. And in fact, the League of Women Voters of Oregon was not able to take a stand on that measure because of that feature. We had urged the proponents of Measure 46 to remove that feature, or at least modify it or tone it down to maybe a three-fifths vote or something in between, but they refused. So my feeling is, anyway, that if an appropriately moderate constitutional amendment was placed on the ballot for this purpose, that the voters would, in fact, pass it. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Do you have a position on House Bill 2556?
We do not. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thanks very much. And I believe that does complete our testimony, members, on House Bill 2556. And I will close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2556. We have two more bills on the schedule for this morning. Next is House Bill 2910.
Madam Chair, just for clarification, Gibson Esco was inquiring about work session. We were in work session.
We're in both public hearing and work session on that bill. Actually, the House rules for teamwork bills require us to hold both a public hearing and a work session, and so we have now done so.
We don't, Madam Chair, we don't require a vote.
We do not require a
vote. Just a work session.
No motions made. And there was an opportunity to do so. So, is there...
For Representative Buckland, I need to work on these rules. Because that wasn't our intent.
Yes, and I think I have checked that out, and I think that is the correct interpretation. Okay, let's move on to House Bill 2910. Representative Buckley, you are the sponsor of this bill. I don't know if you want to tell us about it.
No, I'd be glad to let the our great
committee administrator. Okay. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2910 and open a work session as well on House Bill 2910. And Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2910 came to me out of a situation in my home county of Jackson County, which many campaign finance and campaign-related bills seem to come from these days. We had a situation where a campaign committee, not a candidate committee, had a treasurer who was suffering from bipolar. She fell behind in her reporting, and even though the Secretary of State's office followed every single procedure to get information to the campaign committee about the violations that the committee is responsible for, in fact, I would even say the Secretary of State's office was heroic in their efforts to try to get the information to the committee. The treasurer simply stockpiled the letters that she signed for in her house and never told anyone. Secretary of State's office has been extremely open to discussing the situation and trying to figure out what they could do legally. But right now, in statute, there is nothing that allows the Secretary of State's office to take into account a mental incapacity. Physical incapacity is taken into account if a treasurer is physically incapacitated. So what this bill does, in short, is simply would put the same requirements on a any kind of political campaign committee on this, that currently exists on a candidate campaign committee. It would require a communication to two
In our cases, we get the letters to the candidate and to the treasurer for a candidate campaign. So this would have a political action committee designate their treasurer for communication, but also someone else in the committee, whether it's a chair of committee or whoever that person would be, to also receive that communications as a safeguard to make sure that this kind of situation does not hit another committee that is earnestly trying to follow the law to the best of their ability. And I think that's in a nutshell. It's not complicated, but it is something I thought it does have a ability to address this fairly and kind of set the same standards for candidate campaign committees and non-candidate campaign committees. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions on the bill.
Any questions for Vice Chair Buckley? Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, you and I have kind of had a sidebar conversation, so let me put on the record sort of how I feel about this. I think the circumstances that led to this are quite unfortunate, but I'm not convinced that the cure is worth the disease. As I've explained to you, I think we get incredible numbers of missives out of the Secretary of State's office, and at some level, people have to take personal responsibility, and you can't solve all problems with another letter, and so I'm not very favorable to this particular proposal, and I just wanted to get that on the record with great respect for your thoughts on this and what you're trying to do.
Madam Chair and Vice Chair Berger, thank you. My experience with bipolar, and I guess I have to focus on this, has been kind of getting thrown into it. I had very little knowledge of what bipolar is until one of my nephew was diagnosed as bipolar, and watching my sister and my nephew go through it was very educational. At the same time, one of my constituents committed suicide in January of 2005, suffering from bipolar. It is a disease that is phenomenal in its ability to take a person someplace where they are absolutely incapable of making rational decisions. And in the case I'm referring to here from Jackson County, that is what happened with the treasurer of this committee, with my friend who committed suicide, extremely bright, articulate person who would never would have thought, the last person in the world you thought would commit suicide. It was one that was taken by this disease. It's extremely powerful. And it is not the only mental health ailment that can take someone, but in this case, it certainly did. And I would just say, with all respect, because I do understand what you're talking about, since we do have it for physical incapacity, it does seem to me it's a matter of fairness that a mental incapacity would also trigger some sort of ability to, for the Secretary of State's office to take into account the extenuating circumstances of the committee.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Roblin.
And thank you, Representative Chair. There, we got a letter from Donna Butler. I don't know if you had a chance to read it. And apparently we do have an administrative rule that allows for that physical incapacity of a treasurer to exempt from the deals.
Right.
I would assume that that same administrative rule could apply to mental incapacity. If you could show that medical incapacity was there.
I think the Secretary of State's office, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Right.
I didn't need to interrupt you.
So my question is, do we need a rule and do we need a law when it appears that the office has done this through administrative rule in the past? Now, we do need a law if we want to add more mail to go out and spend some more money. But we don't need a new rule if we want to just make sure that those penalties aren't imposed if, in fact, there is incapacity. In my understanding, would you agree with that?
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I wish that were the case, and I believe Secretary of State's office will testify on this as well, but they tried. I have to give the Secretary of State's office every credit in the world. They held multiple conversations with the committee, with the treasurer, with the chair of the committee. They tried to find the way that they could take existing law, an existing rule, and apply it to this case, but they were not able to do so, in spite of every effort that they made to attempt to do so. And if they could do it by rule anyway, then I would not be bringing forward this law.
Other questions for Representative Buckley? Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the case at play here, was it a candidate committee?
No, excuse me, Chair Rosenbaum and Representative Hunt. It was not. It was a county political party committee.
So if I can follow up.
Follow up.
So I'm currently under candidate committees. Am I correct? There's not a problem because it will, the notices will go to both the candidate and the treasurer, so you always have a backup. So the core problem here is not candidate committees. It would only be all candidate committees, by definition, would have two notices. Non-candidate committees could have one notice. Am I correctly interpreting that?
Madam Chair, Representative, you're kind of turning it around a little bit. Right now, candidate committees do get two letters, one to the treasurer, one to the candidate. So what I'm proposing with this bill is non-candidate committees have the same communication that the treasurer and another designated official of the committee receive a letter. Just as a backup, you know, these cases are few and far between, thank goodness, but as a backup to keep this from happening in the future.
Vice Chair Berger.
Yeah, Madam Chair, with regard to this, the other point I'd like to make that it won't necessarily prevent this from happening in the future because, case in point, I have a treasurer and I am the candidate and we both use the same address and so I get double everything from the Secretary of State's office. It's a complete waste of the Secretary of State's office, but they have to do it. And so this solution won't solve the problem. If you don't have good oversight of your treasurer as an organization, you will have problems, period. And this won't solve it, in my opinion.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Berger, you're absolutely correct in the regular communication process, but in the case of violations, in this instance, when a campaign committee is found to be in violation, the notices are sent out and the treasurer must sign for them, personally sign for them. So in the case of a candidate campaign, if they both came to my campaign office and the campaign was in violation, I could not sign the letter that was addressed to my treasurer. My treasurer would have to sign that. To sign that receipt of that letter, and I, as a candidate, would have to sign the receipt of that letter. So the Secretary of State's office verifies that both people have received that letter. So in the case of a non-candidate campaign, the same situation would occur. The treasurer would sign for it, send back that he or she had received the letter, and another official from the campaign would sign saying that they had also received the letter. Secretary of State's office, again, goes way above and beyond trying to make sure these communications reach the people who are responsible.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Next, we'll call John Lindbeck. Morning. Welcome back.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm John Lindbeck, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. As I indicated on the sign-up sheet, we're neutral on this legislation. I had three things I wanted to tell you in regards to that. We have had a few complaints like this through the years, not very many, but it does come up. That was one thing. The second thing is that it appears to me that the language, the retroactive language in here, which is on page 2, starting with section 3, gives the Secretary of State quite a bit of discretion on how to handle these cases that would allow us to go back and review them retroactively and consider waivers. And I just wanted to point that out to you, that it does give us a lot of discretion, and sometimes legislators like that, and sometimes they don't. And I'm not going to complain if you give us a lot of discretion, but I just wanted to wave the flag here and give you a little warning that you may want to review that section carefully. For example, there's no definition of physical incapacity or mental incapacity in the bill, which opens the door to a pretty wide possibilities for discretion that could vary from one secretary to the next. And the history behind mitigating circumstances is an interesting one, and I've sort of watched it with some amusement from time to time, watching people debate this, because I really sort of have no dog in the fight. I have no emotional connection to any of these issues. And I sat and I watched a very interesting debate one day when Michael Simon, a Democratic lawyer, and John DiLorenzo, a Republican lawyer, came into the office arm in arm to try to convince the Secretary of State that that the state of the law is that any secretary can by rule vastly expand the list of mitigating circumstances that can be applied to C&E cases, and that it's a responsibility, according to Mr. DiLorenzo, for a secretary to do that. But secretaries have historically been resistant to that, because if you draw very bright lines and make the mitigating circumstances extremely narrow, it cuts down on the amount of discretion, and it becomes a very cut-and-dried process in terms of applying penalties. Were you late? Yes. What were the reasons? And if the reasons you're late that can result in a reduction of the penalty are so narrow, that's a recipe for treating everybody alike. They may not like it, but everybody's getting treated alike, and you take the possible interpretation of a political, of politics entering the process in penalty setting out. And historically, going back several secretaries, they would rather do that, knowing that they are partisan officers in charge of a process that where the accusations of politics entering the penalty setting could really start to fly very easily if you make those mitigating circumstances very broad and have a lot of them. So that's the history. I just wanted to, sort of the subtext of a bill like this that I just wanted to call to your attention. The last thing I wanted to talk about is the cost. There is a small cost, probably somewhere between $10,000 and $15,000, for us to do some tweaking to our new campaign finance database to make sure that we follow our legal obligations to get that second person the notice. We don't have an objection to doing that, but it will require a fiscal statement on this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Limbeck, you do, but now you do send copies, dual copies, for candidate.
Correct. That's correct.
So. Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to note, in Section 3 of the bill on page 2, mental incapacity is listed on line 15 as one of the reasons that specifically if a penalty is imposed due in part to physical or mental incapacity. So what this waiver would, it would target down to the last 5 years, it would make physical or mental incapacity of the treasurer a factor that Secretary of State could waive. This doesn't open up, in my view, doesn't open up Pandora's box, because the Secretary can use political reasons or any other reasons other than physical or mental incapacity for deciding on that waiver, just a note.
Thanks for that clarification. Are there any questions for this witness? No, I guess not. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Yes?
No.
Thank you, Vice Chair Berger. I know you do have to go. And was there a comment?
No,
in this
I
end?
Was just talking to
Mr. Next, we'll call Justin Black. Please come forward. Good morning. Welcome to the Elections Committee.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Justin Black. I'm from the Oregon Education Association. We represent just over 46,000 education professionals. In that group, we also have about over 12,000 members that contribute to OEA PI, our Political Action Committee. That's 12,000 contributions every single month throughout the year in very small increments. And one of the reason I'm testifying in support of the bill today is we contract with a third party, C&E Systems, to do our C&E reports. And one of the difficulties we have is that all of our communications with the Secretary of State are sent to our Executive Director, Jared Carruthers, with the hundreds of pieces of mail he gets a day also. And we have a hard time sometimes sorting that out and getting the right information to C&E Systems so that they can keep our records and get our reports in correctly with the Secretary of State's office and make sure that we are meeting our goals. So I'm here to talk to support. I if you have any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Tell me if this would work. Thank you, Madam Chair. Instead of mailing a second piece out, do you think it would be helpful at all to get an email notification that a that there is a letter out there, and so you would know to look for it, or at least to
Or even an electronic copy of the letter would be great.
Okay. That was it.
Okay. And any other questions for this witness? Yes, Representative Redmond, please go ahead.
This would make it mandatory for every organization to get the second letter. And so following up on what she's saying, if there was a process by which you could just, if an organization wanted to, they could ask the Secretary of State to send an email copy of notifications, and once notified, they would do that. Would that work?
Yeah, that would also work for us.
Okay.
I think right now we're dealing with just the limitation of only one letter going to one person.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I missed that. Could you repeat the question?
My answer was, would it be okay if it was just a request? I request the Secretary of State to send me an email notification that this is happening, mm-hmm. and if they could respond to that and say yes, and all of a sudden they would do an email sent to him. He said that it would meet their requirements of having mm-hmm. that other notification.
And you said yes?
Yes.
Was your answer? Okay, great. Representative Hunt.
Could we actually, I think Jim was just whispering as well, I wonder if we could hear from Mr. Lindback on that question, because I'm afraid that change might explode the fiscal on this. I think it might be a good change. It just might take a $10,000 or $15,000 fiscal. And
okay, well, we'll ask him to come back up as soon as we are sure we don't have any other questions for this witness. And it looks like there aren't any, so thank you very much. Oh,
is there? Just a compliment on his tie. It's a very nice tie.
Yes, very nice tie.
That's a point of two today.
And, yes. Mr. Lindback, welcome back. And please identify yourself again for the record.
Again, John Lindback, Director of Elections, Secretary of State's Office. If I understand the question correctly, if the bill is changed so that it's an email notice rather than a mail notice.
For the second person.
I don't think it would make a difference in the fiscal. I think our assumption was that we would be sending out email notices, frankly. And our system already does send committees email notices. It's a matter of an expansion within the system to mm-hmm. cover these committees. So you're already getting a ton of them. So it's like I said, not a big complicated job. It's but there is some cost involved.
And yes, Representative Roblin.
Though if it's just email, we're not spending the extra money that would have been on postage and so
right.
on. And most of, and at least the certain letters are the expensive ones. So that receipt required
right.
Kinds of letters. And many of them are not, but right. those can be up to $5, $6, $7 a piece.
Right. Penalty notices, we have a requirement, as I understand it right now, that any penalty notice has to be sent, as you say, the expensive route. If that second notice doesn't have to be sent, can be sent, the second notice meaning the second person, even on a penalty, could be sent by email, that would reduce the cost by about $3,000 or $4,000. My $15,000 cost had built into it about $3,000 or $4,000 extra dollars for a second person to receive those pricey penalty notices.
Yes, follow up.
Follow up, thank you. On the other side of the issue with regard to the restrictions and how the definition is not there about mental and whatever incapacity, does this bill give you in the office the authority to write administrative rules that would tighten that down?
We could.
Okay.
We could. Future secretary could
change them.
Undo them.
And I assume there probably are some definitions elsewhere in the statute that we could rely on too. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Lindbeck.
Madam Chair, I wanted to point out that you have testimony also from Donna Butler from Capital Accounting Service in Silverton that was distributed to the committee and will be in the record of this measure.
Okay, committee members, we are in a work session. So I will entertain a motion. Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill, which one are we on now? It's just over here. 2910 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Buckley moves House Bill 2910 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Their discussion, committee members. Representative Roblin.
Yeah, I just want to make the comment. I too, feel that it is important that rule be established to limit the definitions of those two categories. But I think it is important to keep that the office on a pretty straight line. And I understand the concerns that they might have. We could put it in the bill, but I think that gets harder as well because you don't really understand. And as you found over time, things like bipolar disease is one of those things that we threaten to know more and more about. And at one time, they may not have even considered that to be a problem. And today, I think most people understand the complexity of that individual disease. And so I think there needs to be the latitude to be able to be flexible in understanding as we get better knowledge about things to have that availability and not have to come back each time to ask for us to extend it. So.
Thank you. That's a helpful clarification. Other comments from committee members? Representative Thatcher.
Am I to understand, just looking at Donna Butler's letter, she's indicating that under number one, in the first paragraph under the bolded area, that this proposal would require all committees to designate a second person. Is that how you look at this?
Representative Thatcher, that's a good question. Representative Buckley, do you have an answer for that? And perhaps Mr. Lindbeck as well, although we are on a motion, but I'll entertain a clarification if there is one. Perhaps the administrator could look at this as well.
So there's the answer. I believe the answer is yes. As our great administrator is pointing out, Section 1, subsection I, does follow from down from subsection 1, Treasurer's Blue Committee shall file a statement, and taking it all the way down to I, it is the name, address of a person other than the treasurer designated. And on page 2, line 3, there is also shall also provide.
Right.
And so this would be a requirement.
Right, I think that's the answer then. The answer is yes.
I guess I have a little bit of a problem with that. Sometimes you have really small committees, and maybe you don't really have another person to designate. Mm. And I just think it should be optional, for sure, rather than a requirement.
I'm sure we get clarification, Madam Chair, from the Secretary of State's office. But I believe you have to have more. It can't be just a one-person committee. I don't believe.
Well, no. I mean, you've got a treasurer, a candidate, and right. Maybe you don't have another person.
And this actually, I think, is meant to apply to other kinds of committees other than candidates.
Oh, okay.
It's already the candidate gets a notice in addition to the treasurer, so unless that's the same person. Other comments? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, a couple things, Madam Chair. First of all, I think this is a good bill in trying to get people to have a secondary correspondence. I think that's good. I think it can be done internally. I don't think it needs to be done in this manner. More importantly, the thing I object to on this bill is the fact that it goes back retroactive. I don't like retroactive bills, period. Why not go back 20 years? What about the people that we didn't know made errors 20 years ago that we didn't understand? So I guess my contention always is retroactivity is not a good thing in a bill, I don't feel. I think if we ask the Secretary of State, I think they could amend their reporting contributions and reporting status to take care of a secondary person on a PAC, and I can't see that it's that big of a deal myself.
Okay. Other comments?
Well, yes, I just want to say I too have an issue with the I guess the retroactivity bothers me. Plus, how I guess I'm not real clear right now. Maybe you can clarify this for me. is it in rule that if a person is physically impaired as the treasurer, that, okay, so right now it's in rule, and now we're putting it in statute.
I would need clarification on that. I understand, actually, it's in statute. That
it is in statute. Okay, because I didn't see it. Okay.
Yes, and that's what kept Secretary's office from being unable to address it.
Okay,
but I guess only for physical.
My concerns were, how would you prove it, I guess? I mean, that you had a physical or a mental capacity. Physical incapacity is a little more readily apparent than a mental incapacity.
I believe even with physical incapacity, it does take a medical professional to verify physical incapacity. So this would be the same case where mental incapacity would have to be verified by a medical professional.
Is that defined somewhere that would be the case?
It's not. It's not defined here. So
it would have to be done, I assume, by administrative rule, just as we were talking about earlier. So,
okay, then that brings me back to, why isn't this just done administratively?
Because right now, statute does not direct the Secretary's office to do that by rule. Right now, physical incapacity is in statute, but mental incapacity is not.
From the earlier testimony, it sounds like that they made every effort to try to deal with the situation and weren't able to without changing the law. So, okay, seeing no further comments, we are on a motion to send House Bill 2910 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Will the committee assistant please call the roll?
Just take it away.
Aye.
Carry it
away.
Aye.
Nay.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. No.
Excused. Aye. Okay, the motion carries. And Representative Buckley, would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
Yes, I'd like to. Thank
you. Okay. Representative Buckley will carry the bill. And I will close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2910. Committee members, we have one more bill this morning. I will open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3282. And Mr. Stembridge, would you please tell us about this bill?
House Bill 3282 has a lengthy summary there. Many of these provisions were in ballot measure 47. If you'd like, I can go through those provisions.
I see that we have Representative Buckley, who is the chief sponsor of this bill as well, at the witness table. Perhaps we should let him testify, and then we can have you add anything that needs to be added. Good morning, Representative
Good morning.
Buckley.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's great to see you. The last bill we just went through had complexity. This one multiplies that complexity by a few thousandfold. I want to just make a brief kind of personal comment about kind of the journey that I've had with measures 46 and 47. This is an effort on, this is kind of campaign finance from day here for our committee. And 46 and 47, as you know, were the initiatives that were on the ballot in November. I was part of the group that helped develop 46 and 47 in an act of hubris, I'd have to say. I believe that by getting things in motion that I would have the ability to change things with the groups involved to continue to evolve the best policy as we set forth. My ability to do that was obviously not what I thought it would be. In the course of negotiations on 46 and 47, we were not able to find the way to come up with the best possible policy for the state of Oregon in terms of campaign finance reform. So I had to step away from the effort reluctantly, because I passionately believe we need campaign finance reform. As part of my ongoing communications with people involved with this effort, I did promise I would take the provisions of 47 since the voters passed Measure 47 and the Secretary of State's Office, Attorney General, did find that
without the constitutional amendment, the major provisions of 47, the limits, specific limits on campaigns were unconstitutional. There were still disclosure parts of 47 that the voters did pass, and so I promised I would bring those forward to this legislature to bring them into consideration for passage by the legislature. Some of these provisions are extremely complicated and will probably take more than the time we have allowed today to discuss them. The attorney who was the major force behind 46 and 47, Dan Meek, was not able to be here today. Our chair has kindly informed Mr. Meek through me that there will be a second public hearing to allow him to explain these provisions, because they can be extremely complicated to go through with the approach to having a contributor have a handle, for instance, to identify themselves. The major desire, if I can kind of give an executive summary, the major desire for these disclosure provisions was to be able to make it very clear who is backing what campaign, and to allow, similar to the effort that we made with the House Bill 3258, I believe, last session, that created the database the Secretary of State's office has, that would allow a voter or any interested party to go to a database and find out who's contributing campaigns instantly. And Mr. Meek's proposals in Measure 47 had to do with the creation of a handle that would identify contributors, so that if, for instance, Representative Thatcher was contributing to my campaign, when she made her contribution, she'd be assigned a number that would be, you know, it would be Kim Thatcher. We would sign up, you know, with her information, so that she would be identified, and then she would have a number or some sort of handle that if someone wanted to look at the other contributions that Kim Thatcher made to Representative Hunt's campaign, Representative Roblin's campaign, they could simply type in that handle into the database, and all the contributions from Kim Thatcher would come in on the screen, and they could see that her support for Democratic candidates had listed in the amounts that
I think Representative Esquivel and I are hurt that she
I feel slighted.
This was supposed to be a secret.
So this database would allow for no secrets in that regard. And that is the intent behind the handle disclosure. There's also a provision dealing with independent expenditures, that any independent expenditure during any two-year election cycle in excess of $1,000 that must be publicly reported in the same manner as a political committee would report. So, for instance, I'll use Chair Rosenbaum as an example then. If Chair Rosenbaum was making a $2,000 independent expenditure and she was going to do a radio campaign to support Representative Esquivel in his campaign, Chair Rosenbaum would have to report that contribution as if she was a political action committee. Right now, there is no requirement for Representative Rosenbaum to report that independent contribution. She wasn't telling Representative Esquivel she was going to run this radio campaign. Just out of the goodness of her heart, she hired some people, put together a radio campaign, and booked it on radio stations in Jackson County to back Representative Esquivel. Under the provision in House Bill 32, she would have to report that. We also get into provisions that have to do with the personal money expended on campaigns. Every candidate who spends more than $5,000 of personal money on a campaign for public office would have to disclose in every subsequent campaign ad the amount of personal money being spent on the campaign. For instance, if our committee administrator decided to run for governor and was funding the campaign by himself, he would have to say, I'm Jim Stembridge, and I have funded this campaign with $50,000 of my own money. Something along that line would have to be disclosed in the television advertisements and radio advertisements or print ads. There's a provision that has to do with actually, I'm not sure if we got that provision in this bill or not, so I won't mention that right now. I do have an email to you from Dan Meek I need to distribute as well. There's also just a provision to make sure the database information gets up. I'm not sure if I could just a minute. I do have on my desk there an email from Dan Meek.
I'll distribute them.
Well, my apologies. The Mr. Meek does say that we did inadvertently leave out some provisions that did not get into 3282 and the personal contribution limit is not in this bill, but would be amended into this bill should the committee decide to move forward with it. And at this point, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that you have, if I can. If not, I'd be happy to relay questions that are immediate questions to Mr. Meek, or I'm sure Mr. Meek will be here at our next hearing to answer these questions himself.
Okay. Any questions, Representative Esquivel?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, on line 23, first page, it says, small campaign items on 20 means small items, blah, 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 blah. Then it says signs smaller than 6 feet square. Why would we talk about signs? Shouldn't it be kind of the amount of the money going into a campaign instead of a sign?
Representative, thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, thank you for the question. I believe this is in regards to... it's going to be a definition that small campaign items will not be required to have the same disclosure information as other campaign items. So a small campaign item such as a button, pin, sticker, bracelet, and pen, you would not have to put on the same disclosure information. You would not have to put on your button. I personally paid for this. And on signs smaller than 6 square feet, you would also not have to put that information
follow up,
on.
Madam Chair.
Yes, follow up.
I believe the way it's worded now, you can do a 4x8 sign and you do not have to put your committee or who it was paid for. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Roblin.
On page 2, it talks about video transmissions and you need to have it on the material within 5 days of transmitting of a video. So you have a video that's running the whole campaign. Do you have to redo the portion that talks about it each time you run it after that so you will be within the five-day period of when you need to have the correct information on it?
Representative, if you could point out the section of the bill you're referring to.
Oh, sorry about that. It is on what would be Section 3, Sub 3. It says, for the information on printed material within 10 days of printing the printed material or within 5 days of transmitting of a video or audio communication. So the printed material I understand because that has to be 10 days before you print it. But audiovisual, we play that over and over again during a campaign. And so the way I read this, I would have to redo that video if I got different contributions that came in and I wanted to run it again after 5 days.
Madam Chair, Representative Roblin, I believe that is correct. You would be required to do another version of that ad to disclose the updated information.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I was thinking of little teapots when I'm reading about handles. Could you explain what a handle would be for contributors? I'm looking at this. I still don't understand what's trying to be accomplished.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Thatcher. Right now, we do have voter identification numbers, and there has been some discussion that a handle could be the same as a voter identification number. You could look up the voter identification number for Representative Hunt and then use that number to find out where he contributed money, what campaigns contributed money to. There's a concern that number one, not all contributors are registered voters, so that would leave a gap there. And number two, that out-of-state contributors would not have an Oregon voter registration number, so I'm not sure whether that would work or not. So Mr. Meek, I think, is moving towards the idea of having a different identification number, basically, almost like a PIN number that you would have for your debit card. You would have a number that would designate you in the system. And so instead of trying to, if there are seven Kim Thatchers in Oregon who contribute to political campaigns, your identification number or handle would identify that these contributions all came from you, not the other one of the other six Kim Thatchers. I hope that's clear. But
well, Laura. Okay. Yeah. I guess I can see that. What are you trying to do? That's a good explanation.
That's
thank
good
you.
Explanation.
I was just wondering what the heck was.
Representative Hunt, did you have a question?
Yeah. Well, Representative Buckley, I was surprised that the bill has a provision that prohibits corporations or employers from requiring employee or contractors to make contributions or expenditures to support or oppose a candidate. Corporations or employers currently may require employees or contractors to make contributions or expenditures?
Currently, Madam Chair, my understanding is that they may not currently. I believe this comes from, Mr. Meek could elaborate on this, I believe this comes from the idea that Measure 47, as written, would have outlawed corporate contributions to campaigns. Therefore, Mr. Meek, and again, he will speak to this, I'm sure, was seeking to make sure to clarify that if corporate contributions are no longer accepted to candidate campaigns, then a corporate official could not pressure an employee to make a personal contribution to kind of get around that law. So he will speak to this, I'm sure, when he is here. But I believe it is coercion is illegal currently.
And that actually gets to the second question. Can you talk about how this particular measure and Measure 47, I realize we have Measure 47 now sitting in statute because it passed,
right,
but not implementable because there is no constitutional framework for it. Talk about how this intersects or doesn't intersect, corrects the problems with Measure 47 or doesn't.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. It's an excellent question. Right now, the entirety of Measure 47 is seen in limbo. If, for instance, a ballot measure came forth in 2008 that changed the Constitution to allow for limits on campaign contributions, the entirety of Measure 47 would become law immediately, as soon as the constitutional amendment was in effect. These provisions before you in House Bill 3282 are provisions that the Secretary of State's office and Attorney General's office have ruled do not fall underneath that constitutional amendment trigger. So could be put into statute without, to my understanding, again, I'm not a constitutional attorney, and there might be testimony that could contrast this, but that these portions of 47 could be put into place. The Attorney General and Secretary of State's office did say that because the way 47 was written, none of it can go into place until the Constitution amendment is put in place. However, these provisions, it is believed, if taken out of 47, would be able to become law if the legislature passes them without a constitutional amendment.
I have one more
follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is there another vehicle that's floating or that's coming that would actually try and fix the problems of 47 in case we want to or someone wants to actually refer out a constitutional measure that would allow those restrictions?
Chair Rizman and Representative Hunt, every single night when I go home, I'm working. It feels like that sometimes. I am working. I actually do have a proposal in that I have not been able to flesh out and have not been able to get the kind of support that I feel would be necessary to pass through this legislature. So I am still working on an alternative to 47 that would be able to go to the ballot in 2008. But I do not have, at this point, I can't say with any confidence that I will have something that will be, that this legislature would be able to look at and say, yeah, this is the way to go.
Okay, any further questions? Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, getting back to what Representative Hunt was talking about, prohibits corporation or employer, what about unions?
Madam
Chair, do they just take a amount of money out of someone's paycheck and put it in the PAC?
Madam Chair, Representative Escobar, this would not limit the union's ability to have their members contribute to their political action committees. And there have been many ballot efforts to put into law to outlaw the union's ability to do that. However, the unions, I think, would argue that part of membership in their union gives them the ability to use some membership money for political activities.
Representative, what I'm asking, do the unions today get the permission of the people that they're taking the money for political contributions? Do they get their permission?
Madam Chair, Representative Escal, to my understanding, when you join a union as part of your membership dues can go to political activities. Unions are not required to meet with each individual union member to ask whether the specific part of their contribution that goes to political activity is spent the way that that union member requires or would like it to be spent.
I think I might be able to shed some light on this, though, because there are also voluntary political contributions, and for those, people do have to sign off on them. And in addition to that, the law requires that people, if they choose to do so, have the opportunity to withhold the portion of their dues other than that which goes to collective bargaining. So
they do have an option.
They do have
an
option. That's right.
Where I was getting at.
Should have asked the chair.
Sorry, wrong person.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Representative Buckley. We do have one more witness signed up, and that is John Lindbeck.
Madam Chair, while Mr. Lindbeck is coming up, I also I wanted to point out that we have written testimony from Donna Butler, Capital Accounting Service, which is part of the record.
Mr. Lindbeck? Introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning again. John Lindbeck, Director of Elections, Secretary of State's Office. I wanted to talk about four things. I'll try to keep it brief because I know you're going to be bringing this up again later. At least that's what it sounds like. With respect to Measure 47, just to make sure that everybody's clear on that, the voters, of course, adopted Measure 47. It had an immediate effective date, which meant that it went into effect 30 days after Election Day. And we were required to take a look at that and review it. Section 9F of that measure said that no part of this act, meaning the whole thing, takes effect until limits on contributions or expenditures are placed in the state constitution. Therefore, we issued a letter that said that. Mr. Meek has sued the state over that interpretation, arguing that Section 9F, which he wrote, is unconstitutional. That litigation is full bore and very expensive and going on right now. So that's the context under which we're operating with this bill. There appears to be sections in this bill, but I'm not sure why they're necessary. And I think in the further review of the bill, for example, the language that requires a state database and all that stuff, I don't see why it's necessary to be in there any longer since we already have one. I do think that this issue of the handle, if the committee is interested in going forward on this, needs to be discussed thoroughly because it raises a variety of issues. There is, of course, a fiscal issue, which is substantial. From our penciling it out, when we testified before the Fiscal Impact Committee of Measure 47, for all of Measure 47, we submitted, and the committee agreed, a price tag of over $1 million. The largest single chunk of that, about $300,000, was to try and cope within our system, our new system, with this issue of the handle, and how to deal with that. And I think people need to think very carefully, and you know, I don't know what the right venue for that is, but how we expect an individual contributor to be aware that they are to go to the Secretary of State's office and get their handle. And I see in Mr. Meek's note that you know, he wants a provision that they are required to update their handle. And it raises questions like, as Mr. Hunt is, or his treasurer is going through his list of contributors and sees his annual contribution from Representative Thatcher, and there are 9 Kim Thatchers, what if Mr. Hunt makes a mistake and picks the wrong one? Is that penalty territory? I think it places a burden on the campaigns, frankly, that you may want to think about in terms of the expectation that you're going to be going through John Jones's and Bill Johnson's. Right now, I hear many complaints about the ability to just get occupational information. And it is placing what I would view as a substantial new requirement on the campaigns in terms of reporting. And generally, if you get it wrong, you get penalized in some way. And so I think all of that deserves a thorough discussion by this committee with us about guidance from you on how you expect this to work. Because... frankly, I appreciate conversations like that. I appreciate that more in terms of guidance to us and how it's expected to work than if you just simply say, adopt it by rule and go figure it out. That's pretty much a no-win situation for us because whatever we come up with, and somebody's unhappy. And it's much more beneficial if we have these detailed conversations up front. I also want to talk just briefly about this has an immediate effective date. That's unrealistic, particularly on something like this handle provision, which will take us a lot of time. It's very complicated technically to do in our system. It will take us time to get it done and thoroughly test it, and that provision and maybe some others in our future discussions on this, we need to think about moving the effective date out so that it's realistic and that we can do it. And I do not recommend making changes to any kind of campaign finance law or initiative referendum law in the middle of a campaign cycle where people have already started. These things should, now that everything is based on a calendar year, these things should take effect at the beginning of a calendar year. And I would argue with this one, you know, the soonest it should take effect would be a year and a half from now. And it would probably be wiser to make it 2.5 years from now in order to make sure that this thing is adequately built, is working like people want it to, that it will take a massive information campaign, I think, in terms of placing a new responsibility on the contributor that you are required to go as a contributor to the Secretary of State's office and receive a handle. And in essence, register with the Secretary of State's office as a contributor to campaigns in the state of Oregon. And not only that, but this requirement is placed on people from outside the state as well. And what are the penalties for people who fail to do that? So it raises lots of questions. We're neutral on the bill. We're not saying that we're opposed to any of this, but it is a big, complicated subject that requires a lot of discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Ms. Limick, thank you. I take your comments. They're well taken. I think it's really on the effective date on this, and I just on the database question, you know, whether this is necessary or not. Currently, if I wanted to find out if Representative Thatcher, how many Democratic campaigns she contributed to, I could find that on the current database by typing in her name, or how could I do that?
You could, and I think that the idea behind a handle, I understand why people want that, you know, because right now, for example, you can go to our searchable database and you can type in the word Nike. And it's pretty interesting because we did it for a demonstration for reporters the other day. Mm-hmm. And the different ways that campaigns report a contribution from Nike, there were like 5 or 6 different ways of reporting was, you know, Nike Incorporated, Nike Corporation. And the same thing goes with names. You know, Bill Johnson, William S. Johnson. And campaigns, you know, there really is no way currently to sort of lick that problem. That if you're looking for contributions from Bill Johnson, you got to pretty much know that you got to look it up in a variety of different ways, or just write Johnson and look at all the Johnsons, and pretty soon that's going to be pretty cumbersome. You know, as of the other day, we already have, in what is a very light activity period, really, 30,000 transactions filed in OurStar. And this is a light period of activity. So, you know, as time goes on, there's a way to drill down into that searchable database to find William Johnson and so on, but that's sort of a complaint of people who do this research, is that you can look up a William Johnson, but you can't feel 100% confident that you're going to have all of his contributions, because you may not have the name exactly right the way different campaigns report it. And so I can understand why people would like a handle. But it does raise other issues in terms of what is the legal responsibility of the contributor, what if they don't do it, what are the responsibilities of the campaigns to get it right when they're reporting a contribution from a contributor, in terms of have they got the right contributor and the right handle, and what are the penalties if they don't.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes, Representative Roblin.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. The question that I have is that, you know, I talked to a lot of people during campaigns, and this puts a whole lot of pressure on a few campaigns and almost no pressure on a whole bunch of other campaigns because of the amount of money that's coming in and the amount that's being spent. So a campaign that's going to spend $5,000 or $6,000 following up and finding that stuff may not be as difficult as a campaign that's spending $100,000 or $200,000. And in your mind, do you have how many campaigns are the big ones as opposed to little ones in, like, the House races, the 60 elections? So I think it does put a different kind of responsibility on different treasurers, basically.
Well, just sort of in my observation of campaign activity in Oregon, I think that there's a whole new plane once, in terms of the amount of activity, once you run for the legislature. Okay. I mean, there's sort of a natural divide there, and our laws now do apply to everybody.
Right.
And there seems to be a significant plane between House races and Senate races. And that's where I would draw the three lines.
Okay.
The legislature and everybody else, and I would draw a line between House and Senate races, because there are substantial differences in the amounts of money spent on House races versus Senate races.
Follow up.
So in this kind of, as I read the bill, I'm running for a county commissioner position, and I have a relative in Washington who decides, oh, I'd really like to help. So they decide that they're going to give you $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
That person needs to know that they have to get a handle, and they've got to understand that they have to follow Oregon rules in order to do that.
That's correct.
And we have no control over those people from the state of Oregon.
Trying to find them or find them. You know, I mean, I just see enforcement issues that I have to look at if there's going to be further consideration of this bill, in terms of cost of enforcement.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3282? Please come forward. Good morning, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. I'm David Buchanan with Oregon Common Cause. Oregon Common Cause had followed somewhat the similar path of Representative Buckley and the Hajar of working with, supporting, and ending up not supporting the two ballot measures that were on last November's ballot. One of the factors that makes this a difficult concept to deal with is that it was written and designed to work with the old reporting system. in an era before we had timely or widely available C&E information, in an effort for the public to understand a little bit more of what was going on in the behind the scenes of the political campaigns, the C&E reports would be that avenue for disclosure, but the public wouldn't see a lot of that beforehand. So one thought is, instead of having to wait for the C&E reports to be written and published and made available, requiring a campaign to put snippets of that C&E information in their advertising. That would help to get the public information out and available on a wider basis than it would be through just the normal reporting process. Now that we have a completely new reporting system, now that we have a system that is more timely and more widely available than advertising from a campaign even, it seems like what's really needed here is a chance to let the new system kind of work itself into the political process, let people get used to working with it, using it, learning from it, and then letting that whole new system kind of percolate through the politics of the system. And it may end up being that trying to tell campaigns that they need to advertise little bits of C&E information could be kind of useless when all the C&E information should be readily available through the internet system that we're now learning to live with. So basically, the ideas in this proposal were created in an old system, which really no longer exists. I think it would probably be easier and better to kind of let the new system evolve and work itself into our consciousness of how we work, how we observe and participate in the political process. And then, after that kind of has become clear to everybody what the new world that we're looking at in C&E reporting is, then to sort of say, well, is that adequate information? I actually think that it's probably better information. And I've always been suspicious of requiring a campaign to report information that campaign may regard as not the kind of information they want to disclose. It tends to make them want to disclose it in the most deceptive way possible rather than in the clearest way possible. So it's hard to require somebody to do something that may be perceived as not in their best interest. So it creates a real cognitive dissonance in how campaign advertising is written when it's mandated that such and such information be included. So basically the whole problem of campaign finance has got a lot of interrelated parts. To try and jigger around one part of it without having to seeing how it all fits into the larger scale is maybe not the best way to go about it. Maybe because the whole problem is so big, it's too big to tackle in anything more than parts, but I think that it's not the case. And perhaps as another bill that the committee has, a commission to study the whole subject in the next interim, could take a comprehensive look at how the different pieces of this jigsaw puzzle fit together and then let that process produce a better kind of a whole picture answer to the whole campaign finance situation problem. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to try and answer them.
Okay, any questions for this witness? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much for
Thank
your
you
testimony.
Very much.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3282 today?
I have a question for Representative Buckley.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Did LC ever give you an opinion about the constitutionality of certain provisions in this particular bill?
I do believe that I've gotten so many letters from LC on campaign finance. I will check. I believe there might be, and I will get that to the committee if
All
there
right.
is one.
Thank you.
I don't have one in my file here, but I do believe there might be one.
Okay. This has been a good initial discussion. Committee members, thank you for your attention. And with nothing further to come before us, I will close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3282. And committee members, we are adjourned. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.